I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to Film Chat, a podcast all about guys who decide to stand up to their bosses. A trio of rogues who are sadistic, incompetent, and sexually inappropriate, respectively. Lacking the confidence or scruples to fight the power through legitimate means, they enlist a hitman to help them bump their superiors off. These clowns bungle their way through a string of ineptly executed murderous schemes in a farce that is in no way a suitable model for industrial action or any form of organized resistance, is what I would be saying if this was a pod adaptation of the 2011 film Horrible Bosses, starring a bunch of actors who should have known better, and Jason Sudeikis. Instead, it's a podcast in which we talk about and review films. I'm Sam Foster, and joining me, my co-star in an upcoming film that I will be making, called Lovely and Respectful Colleagues, Danny Moran.
Hello. Hello. It's a little bit different this week. We didn't see any films, but instead we interviewed two key campaigners in the ongoing Living Wage campaign by the staff of the Picture House cinema chain. Don't worry though, because that interview is so passionate, so informative, so exciting that it puts anything troubling the multiplexes to shame. Hashtag cinema is dead, hashtag podcasts on the new cinema, hashtag basically Kubrick. However, we do discuss the news that Rebel Wilson is a rebel with a cause, that cause being defamed by an evil tabloid. And we report on what director Alex Kurtzman's response was when somebody told him that everybody hated his new film. It is not a good response. All of which should leave me just enough time to perform my latest impression. Christopher Walken getting up in the middle of the night and stepping barefoot on an upturned plug.
Go for it, let's hear it.
Ow! Ow!
Some specifics.
Who put the plug there? Ow, the plug is very sharp on my foot.
Okay, we're delighted to be joined by Will and Mariam from the Pitch House Living Wage campaign. Hello.
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 So would one of you like to give a sort of a quick introduction to the campaign and how it started and that kind of thing?
Yeah, so the first guys to start were at the Ritzy, and that happened a few years ago, and they were the first to actually sort of get a living wage from Picture House. They received recognition of the chosen union, which was BEC2. And they achieved the living wage, but they achieved it years ago, and they only achieved that figure. So it hasn't actually risen, and the living wage obviously has risen. So they kind of resurrected the campaign kind of 2 years ago, and then the other cinemas were kind of slower to catch on. The first people to join up to BEC2 with the numbers that were like necessary were Hackney, and then it was us at Picture House Central. And then it's kind of been snowballing from there. So now there's Crouch End, East Dulwich, Brighton, and then all the others who joined up before. So it's getting bigger.
So it's continuing to grow now.
Yeah, and sort of to, encompass more and more picture houses. So that's, it's all of the London picture houses.
So what sparked it off initially? Because I was talking to Danny a bit before you guys arrived. We were discussing how the amount of striking that goes on publicly is not particularly great, and that people basically associate strikes these days with kind of tube workers, and then more recently the junior doctors strike was a very prominent one. But in like the cinema industry or in other kinds of like service oriented industries. It seems to be relatively rare now for people to be organizing and striking. So do you know how it got going initially?
I would say that RITSI had a few members who were particularly active already. And so I guess in a way RITSI was just lucky to have those individuals who were willing to organize, who had had experience before organizing and campaigning for living wage. And so they were just very well organized, and they managed to inspire all the rest of us as well.
Cool. So is there something that particular about Picture House? I mean, because there was a Curzon one as well, right?
Which Curzon sort of threatened. They started joining up to Bec2, and I think Curzon kind of recognised that it would be bad for their image if they let it happen and they let it get to the stage of striking.
Yeah.
So they kind of sensibly gave in.
But sorry.
Yeah, go on.
Well, I was going to say, is there anything about the setup of these cinemas? I mean, because they're both like more, art house or sort of like higher range type cinemas than others. And is there something about the setup of the way that people work there that makes it a bit easier for people to organise, because, it obviously hasn't caught on in, Odeon or in like the broader Cineworld. Obviously, Cineworld owns Picture House, but it's not, like the other Cineworlds have not.
I think the workers at those cinemas are definitely treated worse. I think possibly the positions at those cinemas feel even more precarious. I think the turnover of staff is like far greater. Yeah. Often at Picture House, you do have people staying for sort of maybe like 2 years, 3 years. So you can kind of build a relationship up with other staff and kind of organize. Whereas at these other cinemas where the turnover of staff is so high and the feeling of your position is so precarious, I think there's almost, I don't want to say a lack of self-respect, but maybe a lack of entitlement to your job and your position and actually to fight for a better position, which I think is rare among like most occupations now anyway, which you've sort of seen with the death of unions. I guess it's kind of right place, right time, and that there's the people and there's the environment where they're actually surrounded by like-minded individuals who've got the time to organise and set something up together, which I feel is, probably rare, and especially in cinema work, which is often so precarious and such a high turnover.
And where there is quite a lot of time where you're not doing much in the actual job, where in between films going in and out, there's not much. Maybe
so just insidious plotting.
So you're hosting impromptu union meetings. Tell us a bit about Bec2, because I mean, kind of what you were saying that it's not something you see very much in other industries. I think especially there's obviously a great proliferation of insecure work and zero hours contracts and so on and so forth to make it very, very difficult to unionize. I should mention the Deliveroo strike as well. That's a recent, prominent one. How has sort of Bec2 helped you guys sort of organise and go on strike?
The staff at Bec2 are very understanding. We have a lot of meetings with them, and they're very willing to listen to us. And most of the meetings are actually led by the Picture House staff, and they're just listening to us. So that's why they're our chosen union. I mean, because we actually do have a union that was set up by Picture House itself, which is what they're arguing we should be. They should be the ones representing us. But obviously, we have found a better union.
It feels like it kind of defeats the purpose. By the company.
Yeah, it's a puppet union that was set up by Picture House to kind of deflect from Bec2, and I feel like Picture House have kind of proliferated this. This view that Bec2 are kind of twisting our arms into some kind of political actions that we don't want to make. But I definitely want to say that, if anything, they've just kind of formalised what we've wanted to do. And they've always been kind of more a microphone for what we've wanted to do, rather than kind of pushing us into any kind of action that we haven't wanted to do. Because there's kind of been, at the moment, I think especially, people within Picture House have started to suggest that we've kind of become the pawns of Bec2 and whatever points they want to make, and I really don't think that's the case.
Yeah, well, that's the sort of classic right-wing caricature of unions, right? That it's these kind of driven, like, fanatics at the top who bully everyone into, like, agreeing to go on strike. But that's not been your experience at all. Like, they're just sort of facilitating.
Yeah, definitely, yeah.
So a thing that puts people off striking is the loss of wages, but that isn't the case.
No, so if you're part of a union, you pay a monthly subscription to the union. For us, it's £5 a month for the first year. And then when you go on strike, they will cover your wages. So if you were to work a shift, if you were supposed to be working a shift on the day where there's a strike, they would pay your wages for that day so that you don't actually lose anything on the day that you're striking. And they can also offer support, legal support, and it's all paid for. So it's all included in your subscription.
How is the best way to support your campaign? Is it a case of, should I never go to a pitch house cinema again, burn my membership, which I don't have, but if I had one?
Yeah.
Or, you know, what's the best way to support your cause?
I think the best way is probably just to spread awareness. One of the big things is sort of destroying Picture House's brand image, which I think most people aren't really aware that they're owned by Cineworld, that they have got this huge kind of like capital clout. So I think one of the things is kind of to like dirty up their brand image a bit, because at the moment that's probably like their most successful selling point, is that they can like put themselves on this pedestal. So I guess, yeah, it's kind of like if you can sort of spread the message that's just a veneer. Yeah,
there was a Picture House ad for a while ago that they were showing in front of like every movie, which was like all of these young community people getting together, and they're all sort of building they're like renovating a cinema or putting on
an impromptu
screening, and it's like the community's coming together, everyone's just a regular friendly person with this little company, you know, like come and join in this lovely dusty folksy atmosphere. Obviously they're just an enormous multinational corporation.
Yeah.
Probably when you sort of like attempting to crush your strikers, it doesn't exactly play well with that image. Would you have any advice for people in other like workplaces who aren't used to this type of organizing, how you get into it? Because I mean, if you're in a position of, you know, you don't belong to union, like a lot of people don't belong to unions now, depending on what kind of industry you're in. And you might not be like the entire kind of apparatus of getting involved in that kind of organizing might be totally foreign to you. So do you have any sort of advice as to how to, like, what you should do in that position or how to begin that process?
There is pretty much a union for everything. And I was looking recently, my friend's an architect, and she was kind of lamenting the lack of representation for architects because they work very long hours. They kind of like, at entry level, you're getting abused to an extent. And we looked it up, and there are unions you can join and be represented as an architect. It's just that very few people are. And that's the case for so many industries, is that people aren't actually aware that there is representation available for them. So I'd say for anyone kind of thinking about how they can organise and actually have their say, the first thing is to look into what sort of union you can choose to represent you, because inevitably there will be one.
I mean, a lot of people don't even know what unions are, and that there can be a larger group of people who will represent you, and that you don't have to stand up to your employer by yourself. And I mean, obviously in workplaces a lot of people do come together, the staff come together, they make friends, and they talk about the problems at work, but they don't know that there is actually a way of dealing with those problems, and that is joining a union. So I think just informing themselves would be the first thing to do, and just knowing what their rights are, because it sounds scary, but it's everyone's right, and it's legal, and standing outside and protesting is something that you can do. It's not only certain people who can do it, everyone can do it in any profession.
Yeah, and it should be so much more commonplace, because so many people are working in sort of adverse conditions and being treated so badly that there needs to be some sort of response, rather than, I guess, just like gossiping and sort of complaining in the staff room. You can change that into something that actually changes your position, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. And maybe, I mean, it might be helped by the fact that I think protesting in general seems to be sort of becoming increasingly mainstream. And it's one of those things, like on a couple of the large really big protests, like the Women's March and people who are marching in support of the junior doctors and the NHS and that kind of thing, a lot of people were sharing on social media kind of like ironic signs, or like, you know, I'm so mad I want to eat a biscuit type of like hilarious, you know, English kind of things. And one way to view that is a kind of people sort of stretching protesting muscles they've never used, whatever. It's like people who aren't you know, the kind of furious, you know, people who were in that kind of mindset, who were just like feeling slightly uncertain about it. So you could see it as a kind of encouraging sign that basically more and more people are getting politicized in that exact way, and that you can just sort of transfer that mindset, you know, from the street to the workplace a bit. Tell us a bit about your interaction with Picture House itself, because the thing that sort of jogged to me to try to speak to you guys was my experience of going to Picture House Central recently, picking up a living wage campaign flyer and then having it immediately taken from me like three steps inside the door by a security person. And I was like, what the hell are you doing? I was fairly outraged. And there was two of them, and there was a woman who looked somewhat sheepish that they were even doing it. I was a bit like, why? This is outrageous. This is insane. She was sort of looking at me like, well, you know, that's just what we've been told to do. And it sort of gave the impression of quite a authoritarian and sort of bullying attitude from Pitch House, and also a bit of an oddly disturbed one, because why would you even do that? I mean, I'm not going there to incite people by giving them flyers, you know, so it seemed very strange. But but what's been your experience of them?
Yeah, I don't know if that was kind of a singular incident, and I don't know if that has been happening sort of largely. But I think our interaction with the staff within our cinema has been, on the whole, quite sort of courteous. I don't think there has been like an animosity, and I think it definitely doesn't feel like it's a personal thing. And I think the people who work within like the actual cinema can't change anything and don't really have a say. And our protests aren't really aimed at them anyway. It goes above that. And this is like, the company is so hierarchical that, I don't know. I think they see, I don't know, they're kind of in, I wouldn't say they're in the firing line, but they're kind of in no man's land. And I think, yeah, that kind of sheepishness that you've described is probably like indicative of how they feel, because they're sort of in the midst of this, and they're not really doing anything either way. They're just kind of middlemen.
So, but did you interact directly with the managers, or are you only sort of hear from them indirectly?
So there's the managers that we have, the duty managers and the general manager, who we see on a day-to-day basis. I don't feel intimidated by them in any way, and I think we do have a good relationship, but they also don't seem to really understand our strike and how they could play a part in it as well, and that they themselves are being exploited as well. So there's them, and then there's head office, who are down the street from us but who we rarely ever see, and I feel like the interactions that we have with them are often quite hostile, and that's where the problem is. It's not, and I think the general managers or the duty managers, they can't do anything about the demands of head office either. I don't know.
Yeah, but then also there's this thing of head office kind of distancing themselves from any kind of decisions, because then there's Cineworld on top of that. So at every level, there's kind of this, I don't know, people like relinquishing any responsibility, which makes it a lot easier for them to like get on with their jobs and kind of walk past us and not interact with us over it, because you can always claim it's like, I'm just doing my job, this goes beyond me. So I think, yeah, in the sense of actually like any meaningful conversations with management, I think it's really lacking. And I think until there are those conversations with the people who actually make decisions, which, I don't know, feels really far away.
The RITSI duty managers also strike when there's a strike and the whole cinema shuts down, but it's not the case for Central.
Is that a result of the recognition of Bechtu at the RITSI, or just a generally more kind of supportive atmosphere there?
Yeah, just more of them strike, enough of them strike for the whole cinema to shut down, whereas with Central, it just, business continues as usual, and we're just standing outside.
Does it have, like, an actual impact on the, like, how much of an impact does it have on the running of those cinemas when you strike outside them? I mean, the non-RITSI ones.
Well, at Crouch End, I think they've had support from local groups as well. And at Pitch House Central, we kind of lack a local community to sort of back us up and support us, because, yeah, we're in central London. And in Crouch End, it has actually caused disturbance to the extent that they've had to call in Cineworld staff to man their cinema. And I think it's actually made it quite difficult for them. At Picture House Central, I'd say it runs exactly the same.
Yeah, the one good thing about striking at Picture House Central, even though it doesn't shut down, is its location. So even though that's also a bad thing because there is no community, it's also we're very visible. And that is the flagship cinema, so it makes them look bad. So that's one way it affects. It doesn't really affect business, but it affects their image.
So there was some news recently that the Ritzy had fired its union reps.
Yeah, so some staff have been suspended.
Three of them were fired. They were fired, yeah.
Oh, I thought they were just suspended.
No, they're fired.
And was it? But is that
breaking news?
You heard it here first.
Yeah,
but you won't have by the time this actually is released. But is that because is that directly like is it just presumed that that's related to their union activity or is it clearly you know is that the reason or what's it about? I mean, what has the cinema said?
I'm not sure what they've said. I mean. They're definitely going to fight against it, and they're saying that it is related, so they're going to fight against it. But I'm not sure if nothing's settled yet. So, but obviously, I mean, those reps from Ritzy were very useful to our cause, and so without them, it's going to be harder. And I guess it might intimidate others as well.
Where do you see it sort of going from here? What are the next stages?
It's just more of the same, I think. I think it's going to become an inevitable thing. Every month there's going to be a strike at the London Picture Houses, and it's going to keep going until there's a proper dialogue, I guess.
And do you feel hopeful about getting to that stage? Or?
It's hard to tell.
Come on, guys, Corbyn 40%. It's all changing.
Yeah. I mean, definitely, I don't know, I guess like the resurgence of activism and... maybe, yeah, the resurgence in, like, morals does make you hopeful. But at the moment, it feels, I don't know, just because we're so far removed from the kind of Cineworld hierarchy, it just feels really distant. And they've got a lot of money backing them up, and they've got lawyers coming to strikes and documenting stuff and really, like, nitpicking. They've been quite aggressive. I don't know how hopeful you can be, but you have to have hope. So yeah.
So when's the next event people are going to attend? I went to the one at the Ritzy on Friday. When's the next one? Yeah. If people are interested in joining the picket line,
I think it's 1st of July. That's the next one at Crouch End.
Any big names? Because you had Owen Jones on the stump.
I think Owen Jones said that he would come back. Let's hope he does. So,
good old OJ.
Yeah. And then we do have some celebrity support.
Not physical.
No.
Yeah. There was a Ken Loach quote, right, on your...
Yeah.
And Ken Loach wore a Picture House Strikers badge, didn't he?
Yeah.
To
the BAFTAs. The BAFTAs,
yeah.
Mm. Oh, cool. And there's the London Film Festival is coming up relatively soon. And do you sort of attempt to speak to the BFI to get them to try to avoid Picture House Cinemas, or...?
There hasn't really been much dialogue between us and other institutions. I think sort of the closest we got was Human Rights Festival, who said, sort of, sorry, guys, we agree with what you're doing, but we need to show our films, so...
I remember that actually. Yeah, and it did seem a bit bad, you know. Like, it's literally called the Human Rights Festival.
Yeah,
a bit poor show.
Yeah, well, like last week, wasn't they showing that the housing swindle documentary? It was a bit like, but you don't pay your workers. Striking outside, yeah. And it's like, come see our film about social injustice.
Yeah, that's the whole problem with the image.
Yeah, well, I mean, and I, Daniel Blake, like, was Picture House's film. If you're going to see that film, you're probably going to watch it at a Picture House. I mean, yeah, it's like, it all becomes ludicrous.
But Ken Loach's next movie has got to be a Strikers movie. Just to really drive home the hypocrisy as far as possible.
I just always think that as workers, because we live in a, you know, capitalist system where employer-employee relations are so imbalanced, you do need a union if you want anything, if you want any rights, you need to be part of a union. And if you want rights, you need to fight for them, because you're never just going to be handed over those rights. It's not in the interest of employers to hand over rights to their employees. So anything you want, you need to fight for. Everything we have currently, all the rights we have been fought for and won. Like breaks and weekends, and the fact that children don't work, that child labour was banned. Just all the rights we have been fought for and won. And so if you want rights, you can't just complain, you have to act. That's yeah. my...
yeah, no, I think it's kind of inspiring in a way, because the, partly because these things seem, this kind of action feels so rare now. And when it's only one or two industries doing it, it's very easy for it to be portrayed in the media as like the only people who are grumbling, and everyone else, they're actually, you know, having a great time in their jobs and they never cause a fuss. But when these things pop up, it's a way of making it very clear that the sort of lines that there are between the people who have the power and the people who they employ made obvious. They're made completely stark. Mm. And you can't get away from the fact that, you know, you're visiting this sort of like friendly cinema and everything is like, you know, wood paneled and, you know, all the food is fair trade and whatever. And it feels like the sort of cozy local indie cinema. I mean, a lot of people probably don't even realise that they're part of the same chain. Mm. And you sort of realise that's basically like a curtain that's been put up, and then behind it is just exactly the same kinds of, like, you know, exploitation and power relations that exist in any other industry. So, thanks so much for coming to speak to us. It's been really, really good to chat to you, and I wish you guys absolutely best of luck. This is our brand now.
Thank you.
Yes, this podcast is going to be highly political, alongside the rest of society getting politicized. Episodes 123 through 250 are going to be...
Yeah, Marx's reading of The Mummy.
Yeah.
It's going to be insane. What would Len think of Tom Cruise's performance? You know, hot takes like that.
Have you seen any movies recently? This is the sort of...
You work in a cinema,
this
right?
is the so. After hours yeah. part of the interview, you know.
I don't really watch films.
Yeah. Too busy unionising. Too busy plotting and scheming.
Yeah. Yeah, and the last thing I watched was Dancer in the Dark.
Oh, wow, okay.
So kind of, revisiting that. Yeah, and I mean, again, sort of exploited workers.
Yeah, last thing I watched was I'm Alright, Jack, and then I watched... I don't know, I'm trying to think about the striking films, but...
No, Brassed Off.
Yeah. Oh, right, do they strike in there?
Well, I mean, it's in the background, isn't it?
Right, yeah. Or Billy Elliot.
Billy Elliot, yeah.
All right, guys, before we roast to death inside this incredibly hot studio,
thank you very much.
Thanks so much for joining us, and best of luck out there.
Thank you.
Thanks.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Superhero films announced, casting rumors leaking out. M. Night Shyamalan's film is hated, Paul Thomas Anderson's is fated, Meryl Streep's Oscar tipped, Matt Damon's in a viral vid, Michael Bay's made a mint, that's the news that's fit to print.
All right, back to you. We've done our interview now, that's over. Back to regular back on our regular bullshit. That's what we are now.
Regular bullshit.
So, Rebel Wilson... you remember her from Bridesmaids.
Certainly.
The sort of British... Wait, is she in Bridesmaids?
Yeah.
Is she the British one who gets the... what the fuck am I talking about?
Yeah, she's in Bridesmaids.
She gets the sort of Matt horrible Lucas's tattoo sister, and stuff. Yeah. Is she doing a British accent? Because she's actually Australian.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, this is all coming together. She's also in Pitch Perfect. And she was also in Pitch Perfect 2. But she has suffered a bit of a blow to her career... after there was a bunch of articles published about her, which she claimed was defamation, and she ended up taking Bauer Media, the media group that published the magazines that published the articles, to court over them. I believe Bauer Media also publishes Empire magazine. And in solidarity with Rebel Wilson, I will continue to not buy Empire magazine. So this is a slightly strange story. Basically, the court case revolves around a journalist called Caroline Ovington, who was writing for Australian Women's Weekly. And she claimed in an article that Rebel Wilson had lied to her, but it's like a bunch of relatively trivial sounding lies. So apparently she was, she approached her while she was having her makeup done or something like that. And then they had this sort of pre-interview chat. And then Rebel Wilson claimed to be 28 years old and said that her real name was Rebel. And then Rebel Wilson's actually older than 28, and her real name is Melanie or something like that. And she published this this thing.
It's an expose.
Incredible expose of
obviously Rebel. Person who isn't called Rebel is not actually called Rebel.
I could have
told you that.
It's a. I mean, like the thing that makes this story a bit weird is that the sort of underlying claims themselves are not particularly explosive. But the issue for Rebel Wilson was apparently that she then found that her kind of career was drying up a little bit in Hollywood, and she was going to be in a Kung Fu Panda movie and wasn't in that.
Oh no!
And this kind of thing, because she was, you know, had suddenly developed this reputation as a liar or something like that. And so she took the media group to court. Anyway, the news story here is that she has won her case, and she's very delighted. And she said that she felt the stain had been removed from her reputation. She says, "The reason I'm here is not for damages, it's to clear my name. And the fact that the jury has done that unanimously and answered every single of the 40 questions in my favor, I think proves what I've been saying all along. I was hoping the jury would do the right thing and send a message to these tabloids, and they've done that. So for me, it's over in my mind."
Awesome.
I find it, assuming that, you know, it's correct that she, her, you know, has struggled to get work in the wake of all these things, it is kind of hilarious that as a sort of overweight woman, your career is destroyed by the fact that you said you were 29 and you're actually 37. You know, like, that claim is published in one newspaper, and, like, you know, you can't get work anymore. You're off Kung Fu Panda. And, like, whereas if you're sort of a successful man, you can basically do anything and you'll just be fine.
Yeah.
What would it have been like for her career if she'd done a sort of Johnny Depp style, you know, like thrown a like iPhone at somebody?
She'd
been
driven out, right, with pitchforks.
She'd have been driven out with pitchforks. But yeah. So you got to watch out as a lady in Hollywood, especially if you're not a sort of like traditionally glamorous one.
That's ridiculous. But I mean, Kung Fu Panda 3 is the paradigm of moral certitude.
Yeah.
So I can see why, you know, everyone there is squeaky clean.
Yeah, absolutely. You're not going to be hired. If you're going to play some, I know we've seen any of these films, but if you're going to play a sort of like giraffe, you can do hang gliding or whatever, you've got to be, you know, you've got to be incredibly straight-laced.
I know you haven't seen the film, but it's obviously based around Kung Fu.
I know, but I can't just say Kung Fu, because obviously there's no thoughts going into
why
that.
Would there be a giraffe hang gliding?
What if you're like a mouse who can do mixed martial arts?
There you go.
You know, that would have been better?
Yeah.
Yeah, like
Tom Hardy and Warrior, but a mouse.
Yeah, it's a ladybird. It does Muay Thai, that thing from Ong Bak. With the elbows and the knees. Yeah, everyone in that cast has a blemishless reputation. I don't think Jack Black has said boo to a goose, and nor has a magazine claimed that he's done that. But yeah, funny little tale. Well done to Rebel Wilson. Hope she gets back on her feet. Hope they cast her immediately in the next Kung Fu Panda movie. She's kind of a cool figure in Hollywood, basically for that reason, that it's pretty much her and Melissa McCarthy, right, are basically the only sort of like overweight actresses of like, significance. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I mean, I'd struggle to think of anybody else. In terms of leading roles, prominent
sort of leading roles.
Yeah.
So they're sort of repping
not
for
older
like,
character actors.
So like body shape diversity in Hollywood.
Absolutely.
No shortage of fat guys around.
Yeah. I mean, Kevin James.
Look
has
at
a career.
Fucking Kevin James. That's a good point. That guy is not attractive. He is
not
very,
funny.
Not funny. He's not nearly as funny as either of
not Melissa, good at acting.
Melissa McCarthy or Rebel Wilson. Can't act. And he gets like an entire shit sitcom to himself, and he gets to, you know, he gets to play international assassin, a zookeeper. He gets to do all sorts of stuff.
Here comes the boom. He gets to be
a wrestler
or a boxer or something.
And here comes the boom, that classic film. He gets to be someone who Will Smith teaches how to fuck in Hitch. And, you know, like,
that's true.
We've got to start giving these opportunities to Rebel Wilson.
Yeah, absolutely.
If Paul Feig didn't exist, I don't know what Melissa McCarthy's
It's true.
Opportunities would be. So, yeah. So
right on, sister.
Right, yeah, exactly. Big up. And I hope you did lie about your age and got away with it.
Awesome.
Because that's badass.
But if you got away with it, then it's fine, right?
Yeah, who cares?
Who cares? If you look 28, might as well... I'm 28, why not?
Yeah, who gives a shit?
If I could pass for, like, 25, I would, but I'm 27 and I look it.
You do look it. You look every inch your age. Yeah. You're not carrying 25 anymore.
Oh, no,
sorry, sir. Sorry, buddy, no rail card for you. Too fucking old.
Snag and telephone friends, so you know where she's at. Right, that's enough, now back to film chat.
Last week we reviewed The Mummy, and we were in somewhat keeping with the general critical opinion by saying it was really shit.
Yeah, we didn't treat it very favourably.
Took a massive dump on The Mummy, which incidentally is a sexual fantasy. I really regret saying that the moment I said that.
Yeah, it came out of your mouth. You were like, joke opportunity.
And then I was like, nope. That was terrible idea. Terrible idea. But basically, it's been pretty poorly received, and it's going to projected to lose £75 million for the studio.
Oh, dear.
And it was supposed to spawn this franchise, but what's going to happen now? And a common sort of trend that's happening more and more in film journalism is that people with no tact whatsoever will just ask the people involved in the film what they think about the fact that everyone hates it. This happened with Batman v Superman, and that spawned the brilliant sad Affleck meme. And Alex Kurtzman, the director of The Mummy, he's been being forced by some interviewer to respond to the lack of enthusiasm for his film. His response was, obviously, that's disappointing to hear. He continues, the only gauge that I really use to judge it is having just travelled around the world and hearing the audiences in the theatres. This is a movie that I think is made for audiences, and in my experience, critics and audience don't always sing the same song. And he surmises with, I'm not making a movie for the critics. Would I love them to love it? Of course, everybody would, but that's not really the end game. We made a film for audiences, not critics. Didn't make it for tiny little insects. It's absurd. They don't pay the cinema prices. We didn't make it for critics. So my great hope is that we'll find it and they will appreciate it.
This is the Henry Cavill line. He said exactly the same thing, right?
Yeah, yeah.
It's good. This is like, now we've got a pat line that you deliver as a filmmaker or an actor when your movie was just a totally shitstorm.
Well, the interesting thing is that we get the critics who have their personal opinions, and the thing about personal opinions is that they always come from a place, and there's a preconceived idea which you have to get past as a critic before you start writing your article or your review, and that affects everything. What is going to really matter, I believe, is what the audience says, because they're the ones who are buying tickets, they're the ones who want to see more of this kind of story or not, and so it's the audience's voice is loudest, and after this weekend, the audience will at least partly have spoken.
It's not for people who love films so much they've dedicated their entire life to it. It's for people who like films a little bit and will happily put up with any old shit.
Yeah, which they haven't even done since it didn't make money. I mean, at least with Batman v Superman, that film made money, you know, not as much money as they probably
people went
hoping,
to see it.
People went to see that film, whereas this one is like didn't do well.
He refers to an audience, but there is no audience.
Your audience hated your film. I mean, I don't know what its like cinema score audience rating is, but it obviously wasn't very good. There's a lot of terrible ones, obviously. I think there's a certain amount of wisdom of crowds going on. Like, I don't know if there's been that many movies, if they got 16% of Rotten Tomatoes, there actually are good.
Yeah.
You know, I would be sort of curious to look at the lowest rated movies and try to see which one in the like bottom like 30% and under, which ones that I actually thought was good. But I feel like most of them are bad, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Like, if you get absolutely slated, your movie probably does suck. I mean, there's a lot of movies that probably get high ratings that, like, don't deserve it. But in general, that, you know, it does say something.
Yeah, you referenced the cinema score rating. I actually have the cinema score rating for The Mummy, which was a B-.
Which is considered to be quite bad,
isn't
it?
That's bad. Audience prefer Smurfs The Lost Village. That's an A. Ghost in the Shell is a B. Baywatch is a B+.
Wow.
The Boss Baby, A-.
Wow, they like The Boss Baby.
Pirates of the Caribbean, A-. So, I mean,
that's bad. I mean, they're like, some of those movies are fucking shit. But Ghost in the Shell is not good.
But it's a B.
So it's a good mark better than this one. Yeah. So if you didn't make it for critics, you didn't make it for audiences, who did he make the film for?
Himself.
Alex Kurtzman.
And he loves it.
He loves it. Him and Tom Cruise.
If you were a director and you'd made a piece of shit movie,
yeah,
what would be your line? I mean, like, the thing is, what if he knows it's bad?
He probably does know it's bad.
It went wrong. Like, what's he going to say?
Exactly. What is he? I think that's just why he's trotted out the Henry Cavill line. You know, he's backed into a corner. What are you supposed to say?
Yeah, yeah.
I think my line would be more like the Uwe Boll, like, fuck all the critics. They're a bunch of overpaid hacks. They don't know shit.
Yeah.
And history will judge me. Here's what I would say. Yeah. My immediate answer would be, Taxi Driver come out, it got cunted. And then I would just continue to relay.
Got cunted.
And it would just, I would just go on the Nick Love director's commentary for Outlaw. Everything he said, I would repeat.
All right, so listen, the bottom line is this film got a fucking hostile reception when it came out. A lot of people, a lot of the press didn't like it. Now they thought it was fucking too violent. They thought it was glorifying violence. The bottom line is you're never going to make a film that fucking pleases everybody. You know what? You talk to people these days about... you talk to sort of 18-year-olds about The Godfather and they go, fucking hell, the bollocks. Takes about 3 hours to get going.
Yeah.
When Taxi Driver... I mean, I've got reviews on... You can go online and get reviews of Taxi Driver when it came out. 1976 Taxi Driver come out, got cunted. People didn't get it. They were like, what's that? Oh, it's racist. It's all that. He's a sort of fuck, you know. Oh, I didn't get it. Well, I think, you know what, Dan, and the bottom line is it'll be the film that we remember for the most, and I think we should be really proud of that.
Well, I fucking am, baby. I love you to death. And
love you to death, son.
And this jog on, eh?
Good night, cunt.
You see Godfather, kids, they don't like it. Takes fucking 3 hours.
Takes fucking 3 hours.
To get going.
Yeah.
They're bored, they don't like it.
Yeah, people look back on the shit film I just made, and they'll realise it's the most important work we've ever done.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Good night, cunt.
So, that's the end of this week's film chat. Thanks for joining us on our jaunt into interviewing, which is a fun new way for us to go. Look up the Living Wage campaign. Google it. Follow the people on Twitter. Turn out to their events. It's a great cause and you should support them. As they mentioned, the next one is going to be at Crouch End, right? And I don't know exactly when it's going to be, but Google around, find out, attend, support the cause.
Absolutely.
And next week we're going to talk about what?
We're talking about Baby Driver. Baby
Driver
and maybe Okja, because I believe that's coming out, the new Bong Joon-ho movie.
Yeah, so a guy driving a car and a giant mutant pig on the run.
Yeah, real films.
Real fucking films. Okay.
That's what we want to see.
Yeah. All right, see you then.
Bye.
Bye.
So I wrote like, okay, if you come up here and you fight me, then... I will kick the shit out of you. And actually, we have 5 contenders. So one guy was in Spain already. And then today we have 4 more fights. So they have a good advantage here, yeah? 4 against 1. All the hecklers, all the critics, all the geeks are wannabe filmmakers. And as soon as they do something on their own, it sucks.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.